What does VA mean to me?
A place for my daughter to call home. Thanks to the VA Home Loan.
A new lease on life. The best healthcare team I've ever had is here at VA.
An education and the opportunity to open doors I never thought possible with my GI Bill.
The financial support I need to manage the disabilities I develop because of my service.
Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
Hey guys, this right here is going to be the episode over assessing the heart and neck veins. We are using the Weber Kelly Health Assessment and Nursing textbook, the 7th edition. But don't let that deter you from listening to the material because it's still very good. As a nurse, you're still assessing for LUBDUB, S1, S2 in all the states of the United States, if not the world, right? You're still going to hear S3 in fluid volume overload with your patients and heart failure that may or may not have a dilated ventricle, right? You still may hear an S4 with someone who's having a heart attack, you know, or other pathological issues that will create that S4 sound. So it is still very much the same assessment in Texas as it is in other states in the U.S. So the material is still very good. In regards to the AI host, again, just be mindful of that hashtag tag thing whenever they're getting ready to switch to a different section of the episode. And also the weird things that they call things like vena cava instead of vena cava or digoxin instead of digoxin. Just stuff like that. The material is still very good, very spot on, and I hope that you guys enjoy the heart and neck vein assessment from the Weber Kelly Health Assessment and Nursing Textbook, 7th edition.
Patient's here.
Oh, boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, blood.
He's wearing it, too.
Welcome to the bay. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in the top of the vehicle, it was caved in, and she was hanging out parked in the window.
She's been 45 minutes of CPR. No returns for you. You can stop CPR.
6 over.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we are putting on our clinical hats and taking a comprehensive journey into the core of the cardiovascular system.
That's right.
Our goal is to move far beyond simply memorizing the steps of assessment. We are building a kind of a conceptual study guide.
Mm-hmm.
We want to weave structure into sound, sound into pressure dynamics, and, you know, pressure dynamics directly into accurate clinical judgment.
And that synthesis is paramount.
Yeah.
Especially for, you know, the advanced learner or anyone preparing for exams. The heart's not just a pump, is it?
Not at all.
It's an incredibly sophisticated electrical and hydraulic engine.
Yeah.
And to truly understand the assessment, why we listen where we listen, why we care about, say, a split S2 or a certain pulse variation,
mm-hmm.
we first have to grasp the foundational mechanics.
Makes sense.
So we're synthesizing that complexity, translating findings like an abnormal Gallop rhythm or a displaced apical impulse into definitive interpretations. It's really about building a blueprint for clinical reasoning.
Okay. And our sources today are, well, they're pretty dense. Comprehensive clinical guides focusing heavily on objective and subjective data collection.
Yeah, they link structural findings to pathology really well.
And highlighting critical risk factors, even cultural nuances. So this is a crucial deep dive. Let's just jump right in, shall we? Let's unpack this engine, starting with the foundation. The cardiac structure.
Okay, so let's just orient ourselves first. The heart sits in the chest, obviously. The general area we call the pericardium.
Hmm.
We talk about the top being the base where all the big vessels connect.
Right.
And the bottom sort of pointy end, that's the apex. And functionally, well, the left side of the heart is built differently, isn't it?
It absolutely is. You can think of the right side as a lower pressure system. Its job is just pumping that deoxygenated blood to the lungs, which are right next door.
Relatively easy trip.
Exactly. But the left side, it has to overcome the resistance of the entire systemic circulation head to toes. That's why the left ventricle wall is dramatically thicker. It just reflects that massive workload.
Gotcha.
Okay, so following the blood's path, we immediately encounter the great vessels. These are the, what, four major pipes entering or leaving the base?
That's right. So unoxygenated blood comes back from the body through the superior and inferior vena cava.
Into the right atrium.
Into the right atrium. Then from the right ventricle, the pulmonary artery carries this blood to the lungs to get oxygenated.
And this is the key point, right? The exception.
This is the one that trips everyone up. It's the only artery in the adult body carrying deoxygenated blood. It's called an artery purely because it carries blood away from the heart.
Okay, the exception that proves the rule. So blood gets oxygenated in the lungs.
Yep, then it returns via the pulmonary veins, plural, usually four of them.
Also exceptions carrying oxygenated blood to the heart.
Exactly. They empty into the left atrium.
Right.
And finally, the big one, the massive aorta, takes that fresh oxygenated blood from the left ventricle and distributes it everywhere else.
Driven by that powerful left ventricle we mentioned.
Precisely. Now, controlling all this flow, the valves. These are the essential one-way gates.
Can't have blood going the wrong way.
No. So you have two sets. The atrioventricular valves, or AV valves, separate the atria from the ventricles.
That's the tricuspid on the right side,
yeah,
and the mitral, or sometimes called bicuspid, on the left.
Correct. And the second set are the semilunar valves. You've got the aortic valve leaving the left ventricle and the pulmonic valve leaving the right ventricle.
And they stop blood from flowing back into the ventricles after it's been pushed out?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's worth mentioning the structure holding the AV valves in place, because it's pretty clever.
The chordae tendinae.
Yes. The chordae tendinae people call them the heart's parachute strings. They attach the valve leaflets to the papillary muscles on the ventricle floor.
So when the ventricle squeezes hard,
this whole system tenses up and stops the valves from, like, blowing backward into the atria. It prevents regurgitation, which would be a serious problem.
Okay, structure down. Now, what about the trigger? This mechanical pump needs a precise electrical rhythm to work, right? Where does that heartbeat actually start?
It starts with the master pacemaker, the sinoatrial node, or SA node. It's located high up in the right atrium near where the superior vena cava enters.
And it just fires automatically.
It has the highest coherent firing rate, yeah.
Yeah.
Usually somewhere between 60 and 100 beats per minute in a resting adult. It sets the pace for the whole heart.
So that impulse spreads out?
It spreads across both atria, yep, causing them to depolarize, to get electrically excited, and contract pretty much together.
Okay, atria squeezed, then what?
Then the impulse hits a critical junction box, the atrioventricular node, or AV node. It sits low in the atrial septum.
And why is it critical?
Because it introduces a very slight but crucial delay, maybe a tenth of a second.
Why the delay?
It's like waiting for the doors to close. It gives the atria enough time to fully empty all their blood into the ventricles before the ventricles get the signal to contract.
Yeah.
Ensures a full load.
Ah, maximizing the stroke volume. Smart.
Very. So after that pause, the signal takes off again down the bundle of His, which is like the main highway running down the ventricular septum.
Divides into two.
Splits into the right and left bundle branches heading towards each ventricle. And then these branches fan out into tiny little fibers called the Purkinje fibers.
And those spread through the actual ventricle walls?
Exactly. They deliver the impulse rapidly throughout the ventricular muscle, ensuring a powerful, coordinated contraction from the bottom up, squeezing blood out efficiently.
And we track all this electrical activity with an ECG, or EKG.
Right. The ECG is basically a recording of those electrical events. We talk about cells being polarized, that's their resting state, kind of negatively charged inside. And depolarization is that wave of electrical change that flips the charge and makes the muscle contract.
And those squiggly lines on the ECG readout actually mean something specific.
They correspond directly to these electrical phases. It's how we link the electricity to the mechanics we can hear and feel.
Okay, break down the main waves for us.
Sure. First up is the P wave. That little bump represents atrial depolarization. The electrical signal spreading through the atria, getting them ready to contract.
Got it. P wave, atrial depolarization.
Then comes the big spiky part, the QRS complex. This is ventricular depolarization. It's a much bigger electrical event because the ventricles are so much larger. This signal is actually so strong, it hides the atrial repolarization, which happens around the same time.
So QRS is the signal for the ventricles to squeeze.
That's the trigger for the main pumping action, yes. And finally, you have the T wave. This represents ventricular repolarization.
the reset.
Exactly. The ventricular muscle cells are resetting electrically, returning to their polarized resting state, getting ready for the next beat.
Okay, so that electrical sequence drives the actual mechanical pumping, the cardiac cycle. It's this rhythm of filling and emptying. We split it into two main phases, right? Diastole and systole.
That's the fundamental rhythm. Diastole is the relaxation phase when the ventricles are filling up with blood. Systole is the contraction phase when the ventricles are actively pumping blood out.
And it's all driven by pressure changes.
Completely. It's a constant dance of pressures opening and closing valves. Let's break down diastole first.
Okay, sealing phase.
The ventricles relax after squeezing, so the pressure inside them drops way down. As soon as ventricular pressure falls below the pressure in the atria above them,
the AV valves pop open, mitral and tricuspid.
Exactly. They swing open, and the blood that's been collecting in the atria rushes into the ventricles.
Is that filling all passive?
Mostly, at first. You get this rapid, passive filling phase that accounts for maybe 80% of the ventricular volume. Just gravity and pressure gradients doing the work.
But there's another bit.
Yes, and it's really important. Right at the end of diastole, just before systole begins, the atria give one final squeeze. This is called the atrial kick.
Linked to the P wave we just talked about.
Precisely. It follows the P wave depolarization. This kick actively pushes the last 20% or so of blood into the ventricles.
Why is that 20% so important?
It becomes crucial when the heart rate is really fast, reducing filling time, or if the ventricle itself is stiff and resists filling. Think about patients with atrial fibrillation. They lose that coordinated atrial kick.
Ah, so their cardiac output can drop significantly.
Absolutely. Losing that 20% can make a big difference, especially if they're already compromised.
Okay, so ventricles are full now. Diastole ends. Systole begins.
Right. The ventricles start to contract, and the pressure inside them shoots up almost instantly. The very moment that ventricular pressure exceeds the pressure back up in the atria.
Slam! The AV valves shut.
Correct. They slam shut to prevent any backflow into the atria. And that sudden closure is what creates our first heart sound, S1.
The lub.
The lub. It marks the beginning of systole. Then, for a very brief moment, all four valves are actually closed.
Really? Wow.
It's called isovolumetric contraction. The ventricles are squeezing, building pressure like crazy, but it's not yet high enough to open the outlet valves, aortic and pulmonic. It's like charging up.
Okay, so pressure builds, builds, builds.
Until the pressure inside the ventricles finally overcomes the pressure sitting out in the aorta and the pulmonary artery.
Then the semilunar valves open.
Pop up open. And blood is forcefully ejected out of the heart, into the lungs, and the rest of the body. That's the main event of systole, #34. Decoding the heart sounds, S1, S2, and beyond.
So that whole mechanical dance, especially the valve closures, is what we're listening for with a stethoscope. It's worth hammering this home. The sounds aren't the blood moving, right?
Absolutely. Critical point. Heart sounds are generated by the closure of the valves. That sudden stopping of blood flow creates vibrations that we hear as sounds. It's not the whoosh of flow itself, typically.
Okay, let's start with the normal ones, S1.
S1, the lub. As we said, marks the start of systole. It's caused by the closure of those atrioventricular valves, the mitral, and the tricuspid.
Are they equally loud?
Usually the mitral component, M1, is slightly louder and just fractionally earlier than the tricuspid component, T1. This is because the left ventricle generates much higher pressure.
And where do we listen for S1?
S1 is typically loudest at the apex of the heart, down toward the bottom tip, around the fifth intercostal space, midclavicular line. That's where the mitral valves is closest to the chest wall.
Okay. And you mentioned the clinical pearl for identifying it.
Yes, this is super useful. S1 happens in the exact same time as the pulse wave you feel in the carotid artery in the neck.
Ah, so if you're unsure if you're hearing lub-dub or dub-lub.
Just gently put your fingers on the carotid while you listen. The sound that happens with the pulse beat, that's your S1, instantly orients you.
Nice tip. Okay, what about S2?
S2, the dub. This marks the end of systole and the start of diastole. It's produced by the closure of the semilunar valves, the aortic A2, and the pulmonic P2.
The outlet valves closing. Where's S2 loudest?
S2 is generally heard best at the base of the heart, which is paradoxically at the top, specifically over the aortic area, second intercostal space, right sternal border, and the pulmonic area, second intercostal space, left sternal border.
And similar to S1, is one component louder?
Yes. Systemic pressure in the aorta is much higher than the pressure in the pulmonary artery. So the aortic valve, A2, usually snaps shut a little earlier and louder than the pulmonic valve.
P2. Okay, lub-dub, S1, S2, that's normal. But sometimes you hear extra sounds. What do those mean?
Right. Anything beyond the standard LUB-DUB gives us really critical clues about what's happening with the heart muscle itself or the amount of blood volume. S3 and S4 are the main extra sounds, and they're known as diastolic filling sounds. They happen during that relaxation filling phase.
Let's take S3 first, the ventricular gallop.
That's the one. S3 is a low-frequency sound. It happens early in diastole, just after S2. The cadence sounds like Kentucky, LUB-DUB-D, S1, S2, S3.
Low-frequency. So use the bell of the stethoscope.
Definitely use the bell. With light pressure, it's often faint. What causes it is the rush of blood during that rapid passive filling phase, splashing against the inner wall of a ventricle that's maybe overly compliant or already stretched out due to high volume.
Like water hitting the bottom of an empty jug.
Kinda, yeah. Or into a ventricle that's floppy and distended. Now here's the clinical significance. S3 can be normal in young people, kids, athletes, or during pregnancy.
Right.
Because their circulation is hyperdynamic.
Less.
But in an adult over, say, 40 years old, hearing an S3 is almost always pathological.
What does it point to?
It's a classic sign of volume overload. The ventricle is dilated and struggling to cope with the amount of blood coming in. It's a hallmark indicator of congestive heart failure, CHF. Hearing an S3 in an older adult is a big deal.
Okay, S3 equals volume overload, likely CHF. What about S4, the atrial gallop?
Right, S4. Also a low-frequency sound, so again, use the bell. But this one happens much later in diastole, right before the next S1. It creates a rhythm like Tennessee, T-lub-dub, S4, S1, S2.
So S3 is early diastole, S4 is late diastole. What causes S4?
If S3 is about a floppy, overloaded ventricle, S4 is the opposite. It's associated with a stiff, non-compliant ventricle.
Like trying to fill a tire that's already rock hard?
That's a great analogy. The sound is generated when the atria contract that atrial kick we talked about and forcefully try to squeeze that last bit of blood into a ventricle that resists being stretched. The vibration of that forceful ejection against a stiff wall is S4.
Is S4 ever normal?
Very rarely. Unlike S3, S4 is almost always pathological, regardless of age. It strongly suggests conditions that make the ventricle thick or stiff.
Such as?
Think long-standing hypertension, severe coronary artery disease, CAD, where the muscle is ischemic and stiff, or maybe aortic stenosis causing pressure overload. It tells you the ventricle is working under high pressure and has lost its normal elasticity.
Okay, besides extra sounds, the intensity of the normal S1 and S2 can also tell us things, right? Louder or softer?
Absolutely. The loudness reflects the pressure gradients and the condition of the valve leaflets themselves. An accentuated S1, meaning it's louder than S2 or just unusually loud.
What would cause that?
It often suggests the AV valve leaflets are still mobile, but maybe a bit stiff. They snap shut with more force. The classic example is mitral stenosis. The valve is narrowed, pressure builds behind it, so when it slams shut, it's loud. Also, hyperdynamic states like fever or exercise can increase S1 intensity.
And a quieter S1, diminished.
A diminished S1 could mean several things. Maybe the valve is so heavily calcified it barely moves. Or perhaps there's a really long delay in electrical conduction, like a first-degree heart block, which gives the ventricular pressure time to rise more slowly, so the valve closes less forcefully. Or even conditions like severe heart failure, where the contraction itself is weak.
Makes sense. Same logic applies to S2.
Pretty much. An accentuated S2 means the semilunar valves are closing under high pressure. Think systemic hypertension, loud A2, or pulmonary hypertension, loud P2. A diminished S2 suggests lower pressure, maybe shock or severe hypotension, or again, heavily calcified, immobile aortic or pulmonic valves that don't close with their usual crispness.
Oh, okay. Now, split sounds, this always felt complicated. A split S2.
Right. A split S2 means you can actually hear the aortic A2 and pulmonic P2 components closing separately, instead of as one single dub sound. So you hear doo-dub.
And sometimes that's normal.
Yes. The normal physiologic split S2 is key to understand. It happens only during inspiration.
Okay, walk us through why. It's about breathing mechanics, right?
Exactly. When you take a deep breath in, the pressure inside your chest drops, becomes more negative. This pulls more venous blood back from the body into the right side of the heart.
More blood returning to the right ventricle?
Mm-hmm. So the right ventricle takes just a fraction of a second longer to eject that extra volume of blood into the pulmonary artery. This delays the closure of the pulmonic valve P2 slightly.
But the left side isn't really affected by breathing pressures in the same way.
Not nearly as much. So A2 closes on time, but P2 is delayed. Result, you hear A2, then P2 do dub, but only when the patient breathes in. On expiration, the pressures equalize, P2 closes earlier again, and the split disappears back into a single S2 sound.
Okay, physiologic split, inspiration only. What if the split is always there?
If you hear that doo-dub clearly doing both inspiration and expiration, that's abnormal. A fixed split S2, meaning the split is wide and doesn't change with breathing, is the absolute classic auscultatory finding for an atrial septal defect, ASD.
A hole between the atria. Why does that cause a fixed split?
Because the hole allows blood to constantly shunt from the higher pressure left atrium to the right atrium. This chronically overloads the right ventricle with volume, always delaying pulmonic valve closure, P2. Regardless of the phase of respiration, it fixes the split wide open.
Got it. Fixed split, think ASD. Any other abnormal splits?
Yes, the reversed or paradoxical split S2. This is weird. The split is audible during expiration and disappears during inspiration. It's the exact opposite of normal.
What would cause that? The aortic valve closing late?
Precisely. It indicates a significant delay in left ventricular emptying. The most common cause is a left bundle branch block, LBBB, which disrupts the normal sequence of left ventricular contraction, delaying aortic valve closure, A2, so much that it actually happens after P2 during expiration. Inspiration then delays P2 enough to make them close together again. It's paradoxical.
Okay, that covers variations in the normal sounds. Now let's talk about the extra flowing sounds, murmurs. These are the whooshing or blowing sounds.
Exactly. Murmurs are caused by turbulent blood flow, blood not flowing smoothly and silently like it should.
What makes it turbulent?
Several things. You can get turbulence just from increased blood velocity. Think high output states like fever, severe anemia, or even just vigorous exercise.
Okay, faster flow, more noise.
Right. Or, more significantly, you get turbulence from structural problems. Stenosis, meaning a valve is narrowed or constricted.
Like trying to force water through a tight nozzle.
Perfect analogy. Creates a jet. Or regurgitation, also called insufficiency, where a valve doesn't close properly and blood leaks backward.
That backward flow would be turbulent too.
Definitely. And finally, abnormal openings between chambers that shouldn't be there, like a ventricular septal defect, VSD, cause turbulence as blood jets across the pressure gradient.
Okay. So when we hear a murmur, how do we describe it? It seems like there's a whole system.
There is. And being systematic is crucial for diagnosis and communication. Mm. The absolute most important characteristic is timing. Does it happen during systole or diastole?
Between S1 and S2, or between S2 and the next S1.
Exactly. A systolic murmur occurs during ventricular contraction between S1 and S2. Think about what's happening then. AV valves are closed, semilunar valves are open.
So turbulence could be blood forcing its way through a narrowed aortic or pulmonic valve stenosis?
Right, aortic stenosis, pulmonic stenosis.
Or blood leaking back through a faulty mitral or tricuspid valve regurgitation?
Mitral regurgitation, tricuspid regurgitation. Those are the main causes of systolic murmurs.
Okay, what about diastolic murmurs between S2 and S1?
Now the ventricles are relaxing and filling. Semilunar valves are closed, AV valves are open. Diastolic murmurs are generally considered always pathological or more serious.
Why? What causes them?
Turbulence during filling usually means either stenosis of an AV valve mitral stenosis or tricuspid stenosis restricting inflow.
Or regurgitation through a leaky semilunar valve aortic regurgitation or pulmonic regurgitation, allowing blood to fall back into the ventricle when it shouldn't. Got it. Timing is key. What else do we know?
Intensity.
Yeah.
How loud is it? We grade this on a scale of 1 to 6.
Grade 1 being?
Grade 1 is very faint. You really have to listen hard in a quiet room, maybe only heard by experienced listeners. Grade 2 is quiet but readily audible. Grade 3 is moderately loud.
And grade 4, that's significant, right?
Grade 4 is the clinical threshold. It's loud and it's associated with a thrill.
What's a thrill?
A thrill is a palpable vibration on the chest wall. It feels like a cat purring under your fingers. It signifies very high turbulence. If you feel a thrill, the murmur is at least a grade 4.
Okay. And grades 5 and 6?
Grade 5 is very loud, easily heard with a stethoscope lightly on the chest, still associated with a thrill. Grade 6 is the loudest you can supposedly hear it with the stethoscope just off the chest wall. Also has a thrill. You rarely encounter a true grade 6.
Wow. Okay, so timing, intensity, what else?
We describe the quality. Is it blowing, harsh, rumbling, musical? And the shape or pattern over time, does it get louder, then quieter? Crescendo, decrescendo, like aortic stenosis, stay the same, plateau, or just fade away, decrescendo, like aortic regurgitation. Putting all that together gives a detailed picture.
One more sound that's not a murmur, the friction rub.
Ah, yes, the pericardial friction rub. This is quite different. It's a high-pitched, scratching, grating, or leathery sound.
Caused by inflammation.
Exactly. Caused by inflammation of the pericardial sac surrounding the heart pericarditis. The inflamed layers rub against each other with each heartbeat.
And when do you hear it? systole, diastole.
That's the unique part. You often hear it throughout both systole and diastole because the heart is rubbing against the pericardium during both phases. It can sometimes sound like it has three components corresponding to atrial systole, ventricular systole, and ventricular diastole.
How do you best listen for it?
The classic maneuver is to have the patient sit up, lean forward, and hold their breath after forcefully exhaling.
Why does that help?
Leaning forward brings the heart closer to the chest wall, and holding expiration stops the lung sounds from interfering. It makes the rub much more prominent if it's there.
Okay, we've done a deep dive on the heart sounds, but the assessment doesn't stop there, does it? We need to look at the neck vessels too. They give us clues about the whole system.
Absolutely. The carotid arteries and jugular veins provide really valuable, non-invasive windows into cardiac function and fluid status.
Let's start with the carotids. Location.
They run medial to the sternocleidomastoid, SCM muscle, in the neck. And remember, we already mentioned how useful the carotid pulse is. It's almost perfectly synchronized with S1. Marks the start of systole.
Right. And safety is paramount when checking these.
Crucial. Rule number one, only palpate one side at a time. Never both together.
Why not?
Two reasons. First, you could potentially compromise blood flow to the brain if there's already some underlying stenosis. Second, and more immediate, pressing on the carotid sinus area can trigger a powerful vagal nerve response.
Blowing the heart rate way down.
Yeah, it can cause significant bradycardia, even syncope, in susceptible individuals. So one side at a time, gently.
And you mentioned listening before feeling.
Yes, especially in older adults or anyone you suspect might have cardiovascular disease. Auscultate first. Use the bell of your stethoscope. Lightly place over the artery in a few points low, mid, and high near the jaw angle.
What are we listening for?
We're listening for a bruit, B-R-U-I-T. It's a soft blowing, swishing, or rushing sound.
Like a murmur, but in the artery itself.
Exactly. It indicates turbulent blood flow within the carotid artery. And the most common cause by far is stenosis narrowing due to atherosclerotic plaque buildup.
So hearing a bruit is a red flag.
Huge red flag. It means there's significant blockage, putting the patient at high risk for a transient ischemic attack, TIA, or a full-blown stroke. Needs prompt documentation and further investigation, like an ultrasound.
Okay, so auscultate first for bruits. Then when we palpate one side, what are we assessing?
We're feeling for the pulse strength. Is it equal on both sides? Is it weak, suggesting low stroke volume? Is it bounding or water hammer-like, suggesting high stroke volume or low resistance?
We also check the artery wall itself.
Yes, note the elasticity. Normally, it feels pliable. A hard cord-like artery suggests arteriosclerosis, and just like on the chest, sometimes you can feel a thrill, that palpable vibration over a severely stenosed carotid artery.
Okay, that's the arteries. Now, the jugular veins, these are returning blood, right?
Correct. The internal jugular, deep, harder to see, and external jugular, more superficial, easier to see, veins bring deoxygenated blood back to the right atrium. Unlike the carotid pulse, which reflects arterial pressure, the jugular venous pulsation reflects the pressure inside the right atrium itself, what we call central venous pressure, or CVP.
And why is CVP important?
It's arguably the single best non-invasive bedside indicator of the patient's fluid volume status and right-sided heart function.
So if the pressure in the jugulars is high...
If you see jugular venous distension, JVD, meaning the veins are visibly bulging up the neck, it indicates elevated right atrial pressure. This is a classic cardinal sign of right-sided heart failure.
Why right-sided?
Because the right ventricle isn't pumping effectively, blood backs up into the right atrium, and that pressure gets transmitted directly back up into the jugular veins. You also see it in things like fluid overload, cardiac tamponade, or severe pulmonary hypertension.
How do we actually measure JVP? There's a specific technique.
Yes, positioning is key. The patient should be supine, with the head of the bed, HOB, elevated to somewhere between 30 and 45 degrees. Too flat, and the veins might look full, even if CVP is normal. Too upright, and they might collapse even if it's high.
So 30, 45 degrees is the sweet spot. Neck turned slightly.
Turn the head slightly away from the side you're observing. Usually look at the right side. Use tangential lighting to help see the pulsations. You're looking for the highest point where you can see the internal jugular vein pulsating.
And we measure from where?
We use the angle of Louis, that little bump where the manubrium meets the sternal body. It's a reliable landmark because it's roughly 5 centimeters above the right atrium,
right,
regardless of patient position.
So find the highest pulsation point. Measure vertically down to the angle of Louis.
You measure the vertical distance, yes. Normally, that highest pulsation point should be no more than 3 to 4 centimeters above the sternal angle when the HOB is at 30, 45 degrees.
What if it's higher? or the vein is just visibly distended way up the neck.
Distension greater than 4 centimeters above the angle, or seeing the external jugular fully distended even when the patient is sitting up past 45 degrees, that signifies significantly elevated CVP, indicating venous hypertension, likely from fluid overload or right heart failure.
Let's go back to the arterial pulse for a moment. We talked about weak or bounding, but there are other more complex patterns examiners love to ask about.
Ah, yes, the nuanced pulse patterns. A normal pulse wave should feel smooth, rounded, regular rhythm, consistent amplitude. Deviations tell a story.
Okay, so small, weak pulse, pulsus parvus.
This indicates a decreased stroke volume being ejected. The pulse feels feeble, the upstroke might feel slow. You see this in conditions that reduce output, classic heart failure, severe hypovolemia, like from shock or dehydration, or conditions that severely obstruct outflow, like critical aortic stenosis.
And the opposite, large bounding pulse, pulsus magnus.
Here the pulse feels very strong, maybe even collapsing quickly, a water hammer pulse. It suggests an increased stroke volume or maybe decreased peripheral resistance, so the blood runs off quickly.
What causes that?
Think high output states, again, fever, anemia. Also, conditions where blood leaks back into the ventricle, forcing it to eject more volume next time, like aortic regurgitation, or even just high anxiety or exercise sometimes.
Okay, now for the trickier rhythms, pulsus alternans.
Right. This one has a regular rhythm, but the amplitude, the strength of the beat, alternates. Strong beat, weak beat, strong beat, weak beat.
What does that signify? It sounds serious.
It is. Pulsus alternans is a very specific and concerning sign of severe left ventricular failure. The failing ventricle just can't maintain consistent stroke volume from beat to beat.
Wow. Okay. Strong, weak alternation, bad LV function. What about the paradoxical pulse? Pulsus paradoxus. The name itself is confusing.
It is a bit confusing. It's defined as a palpable decrease in the pulse amplitude, specifically during inspiration. Sometimes it's so subtle you need a blood pressure cuff to detect it accurately.
How do you do that?
You inflate the cuff past systolic, then deflate it very slowly. Note the pressure where you first hear cardiac cuff sounds only during expiration. Keep deflating slowly until you hear sounds throughout both inspiration and expiration. If the difference between those two pressures is more than 10 millimeters G, that confirms pulsus paradoxus.
Okay, but why does the pulse weaken on inspiration in these conditions?
It's fascinating physiology. Normally, inspiration increases venous return to the right heart slightly, but the healthy heart handles it fine. However, in conditions where the entire heart is being squeezed from the outside.
Like pericardial tamponade, fluid in the sac, or constrictive pericarditis, scarred tight sac.
Exactly. Or even severe obstructive lung disease like asthma or COPD exacerbation. In these cases, when the right ventricle fills with that extra inspiratory blood, it has nowhere to expand outward because of the external constraint.
So it bulges inward.
It bulges into the left ventricle via the interventricular septum.
Uh-huh.
This severely compromises left ventricular filling, diastolic volume, specifically during inspiration. Less filling means less stroke volume ejected.
And a weaker pulse felt during inspiration. Wow, okay. That makes sense now. Paradoxical pulse, external compression, or severe lung issues impairing LV filling on inspiration.
You got it. It's a key finding in tamponade.
All right. Before we even touch the patient, the history is vital, right? Getting the story straight. What are the key symptoms we need to ask about for a cardiac workup, using something like cold-ACE PA to really define them?
Absolutely. Chest pain is obviously number one, but just saying chest pain isn't enough. We need the details.
Yeah.
Is it angina? Typically described as pressure, heaviness, squeezing. Often brought on by exertion, lasts maybe 5-15 minutes, and crucially, is relieved by rest or nitroglycerin. That suggests ischemia, temporary lack of oxygen.
Versus a heart attack.
Versus myocardial infarction, MI pain. This is usually more severe crushing, intense pressure maybe radiating to the jaw, neck, arms, or back. Critically, it lasts longer than 20 minutes and is not relieved by rest or nitro. This signifies actual tissue death, irreversible damage. Often comes with nausea, sweating, sense of doom.
You need to differentiate from other causes too, right? Like that tearing pain.
Yes. An aortic dissecting aneurysm causes an absolutely excruciating, sudden tearing or ripping pain, often felt in the chest radiating straight through to the back. It's a surgical emergency.
And the sharp stabbing pain.
That could be pericarditis. Sharp stabbing, often worse with deep breaths or lying down, and classically relieved by sitting up and leaning forward. That posture pulls the inflamed pericardial layers apart slightly.
Okay, beyond chest pain, what other big symptoms? Breathing trouble.
Dyspnea, shortness of breath, is huge, especially for heart failure. We specifically ask about orthopnea. Can you breathe okay lying flat, or do you need pillows to prop yourself up?
Why does lying flat make it worse in heart failure?
When you lie flat, fluid that's been pooling in your legs and abdomen due to gravity shifts back into your central circulation. The already struggling left ventricle can't handle this extra volume. Pressure backs up into the lungs, causing congestion and shortness of breath. Sitting up helps gravity pull some fluid back down.
How many pillows do they use? That's a common question.
Yeah, asking how many pillows do you sleep on is a quick gauge of severity. We also ask about paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, PND.
Waking up suddenly gasping for air.
Exactly. Usually happens a few hours after falling asleep. Same mechanism, fluid redistribution overwhelms the heart during sleep. They have to sit up, maybe walk around to catch their breath. Very specific for heart failure.
What else? Fatigue, swelling.
Fatigue, yes. Especially fatigue that gets progressively worse as the day goes on. That's typical of the decreased cardiac output in heart failure. Edema, swelling, particularly in the feet, ankles, legs, dependent edema, is common with right-sided heart failure. We also ask about nocturia.
Having to get up frequently at night to urinate, how is that related?
Same fluid shift. When the patient lies down, the kidneys, which maybe weren't getting perfused well during the day due to low cardiac output, suddenly get better blood flow. They wake up and produce more urine overnight. It's another subtle sign of fluid redistribution related to heart failure. Okay, symptoms covered. But a huge part of cardiovascular assessment is looking at the risk factors for coronary artery disease, CAD, right? Absolutely. Prevention and risk modification are key. We usually group them into non-modifiable and modifiable.
Non-modifiable being things you can't change.
Right. Like your age risk increases significantly after 65. Your gender men generally have higher risk than premenopausal women, though it evens out later. And your heredity or family history, having close relatives with early heart disease, is a major risk factor.
But the modifiable ones are where we can intervene.
Exactly. This is the crucial list. High blood pressure, hypertension. Cigarette smoking, a massive risk factor. High cholesterol, specifically a high LDL, bad cholesterol, and low HDL, good cholesterol, plus high triglycerides.
Lifestyle factors too.
Definitely. Obesity or being overweight, physical inactivity or a sedentary lifestyle. Diabetes mellitus, which dramatically increases risk.
Yeah.
Excessive alcohol consumption, chronic unmanaged stress.
Yeah.
And a poor diet, high in saturated fats, trans fats, sodium, low in fruits and vegetables. A good assessment screens for all of these.
And our sources mentioned some important cultural or demographic variations in these risks.
Yes. While heart disease is the leading killer across the board in the U.S., the prevalence of specific risk factors does vary. This helps tailor screening and prevention.
For example,
the data shows that both Hispanic and non-Hispanic Black populations tend to have greater stiffening of their carotid arteries with age compared to whites. Non-Hispanic Blacks have the highest rates of diagnosed hypertension in the U.S. and also very high rates of obesity.
And other groups.
Hispanic populations, particularly men, show the highest rates of high LDL cholesterol. Both Hispanics and non-Hispanic Blacks share the highest rates of diagnosed diabetes. Knowing these patterns, like the hypertension prevalence in Black communities or cholesterol issues in Hispanic men, helps focus public health efforts and individual patient education. It's not stereotyping. It's using demographic data for targeted care.
Okay. History and risks done. Now, the actual hands-on physical exam, what equipment do we need?
Pretty basic, actually. Good stethoscope with both a diaphragm for high-pitched sounds and a bell for low-pitched sounds. A pen light can be helpful for inspecting JVP and small centimeter rulers for measuring JVP accurately.
And patient positioning. We touched on this, but recap the key positions.
Right. Start with the patient supine. Head of the bed, HOB, elevated 30 to 45 degrees. This is the standard position for inspecting JVP in general auscultation.
But we need special positions for certain sounds.
Yes. To best hear low-pitched sounds originating from the left ventricle or mitral valve, like S3, S4, or the murmur of mitral stenosis, have the patient roll onto their left lateral decubitus position. Use the bell here. This brings the apex of the heart closer to the chest wall.
And for sounds from the base.
For faint, high-pitched sounds coming from the base, like the murmur of aortic regurgitation or a pericardial friction rub, ask the patient to sit up, lean forward slightly, and hold their breath after full exhalation. Use the diaphragm here. This brings the base of the heart forward.
Okay, got the positions. What's the logical sequence for the exam itself?
Generally, you want to move systematically. Start by inspecting the jugular venous pulse, then move to the carotids. Auscultate first for Bruce, then gently palpate, one side at a time.
Then the chest.
Then move to the precordium. First, look for the apical impulse, any visible pulsations, lifts, or heaves. Then palpate, locate the apical impulse by feel. Check for any abnormal pulsations like thrills, lifts, or heaves across the entire precordium.
And finally, listening.
Finally, the comprehensive auscultation. Listen systematically over the key areas using both the diaphragm and the bell. Identify S1 and S2 first. Then listen specifically for any extra sounds, S3, S4, clicks, snaps, or murmurs.
Let's quickly run through those five traditional auscultation areas again. Pigs eat too much.
Or APE to man, whatever works.
It's A.
Aortic area. Second intercostal space, ICS, right sternal border, pulmonic area. Second ICS, left sternal border, Herb's point. Third ICS, left sternal border, often good for hearing both S1 and S2. And some murmurs like aortic regurgitation, tricuspid area. Fourth or fifth ICS, left lower sternal border. And mitral area, or apex. Fifth ICS, around the midclavicular line, MCL.
Let's dig a bit deeper into those things we might feel on the chest wall, the abnormal pulsations. What do they tell us?
Palpation can pick up significant hypertrophy or strain before you even listen sometimes. A lift or heave is a really forceful, sustained outward thrust of the chest wall that you feel under your hand. It's more diffuse than the normal apical tap.
And where you feel it matters.
Definitely.
Yeah.
If you feel a lift primarily along the left sternal border, it strongly suggests right ventricular hypertrophy, RVH. The enlarged right ventricle is pushing the sternum forward. Think chronic lung disease causing pulmonary hypertension or pulmonic stenosis.
And if the heave is at the apex?
A heave or lift felt at the apex suggests left ventricular hypertrophy, VH. The enlarged left ventricle is thrusting forcefully. Common causes are long-term systemic hypertension or aortic stenosis.
Okay. And the thrill we mentioned earlier, that buzzing feeling.
Right, the palpable vibration. Remember, that corresponds to severe turbulence, usually from a significant valve problem. It's the tactile equivalent of a loud murmur, grade 4 or higher.
Where you feel the thrill points to the source.
Exactly. A thrill felt over the aortic or pulmonic area, second ICS, points towards severe aortic stenosis or pulmonic stenosis. A thrill felt down at the apex often indicates severe mitral regurgitation.
And the location of the apical impulse itself, if it's not where it should be.
That's a key sign, too. Normally, the apical impulse, or point of maximal impulse, PMI, is felt to the fourth or fifth ICS, at or just medial to the midclavicular line, MCL. If it's displaced laterally, beyond the MCL, or inferiorly, down into the sixth ICS.
What does that mean?
It signifies ventricular enlargement or dilation. The heart muscle has stretched or thickened and physically moved. You see this classically in conditions like dilated cardiomyopathy, severe volume overload from CHF, or significant LVH. A displaced PMI is never normal.
Okay, let's talk rhythm quickly. Usually regular, but variations happen. What about sinus arrhythmia?
Sinus arrhythmia is when the heart rate subtly speeds up with inspiration and slows down with expiration. It's actually a normal finding, very common in children and young adults, related to breathing's effect on vagal tone. It doesn't usually require any treatment.
But sometimes you get extra beats, out of sync.
Right. Premature atrial contractions, CANTOSs, or premature ventricular contractions, PVCs. These are beats originating from an irritable spot in the atria or ventricles firing off before the SA node does. You hear a beat come early, often followed by a slight pause as the rhythm resets.
Are they dangerous?
Occasional isolated PACs or PVCs are often benign, especially if the person is healthy otherwise. It can be caused by caffeine, stress, fatigue. However, frequent PACs or PVCs, especially runs of them, can sometimes indicate underlying issues like electrolyte imbalances, potassium, magnesium, hypoxia, or myocardial irritation from ischemia. Needs context.
And the really irregular rhythm, AFib.
Atrial fibrillation. AFib is chaotically irregular. The atria aren't contracting in a coordinated way. They're just quivering or fibrillating, sending chaotic impulses down to the ventricles. The ventricular response is therefore completely irregular. The rhythm sounds all over the place, and the intensity of the beats can vary too.
And this can cause a pulse deficit. What's that?
Yes, a pulse deficit is when the heart rate you count by listening at the apex with your stethoscope is significantly faster than the pulse rate you count by feeling the radial artery at the wrist.
Why the difference?
In AFib, many of those rapid, irregular ventricular contractions are quite weak. They happen so quickly after the previous beat that the ventricle doesn't have time to fill properly. So while the heart contracts, you hear an S1, the stroke volume ejected is too small to actually open the aortic valve strongly or generate a palpable pulse wave out in the periphery.
So you hear a beat, but don't feel a pulse.
Exactly. You might count an apical rate of 110, but only feel a radial pulse of 80. That difference of 30 is the pulse deficit. It signifies that many heartbeats are ineffective in terms of circulation. And it's a major concern in AFib because that ineffective pumping and quivering atrium increases the risk of blood clots forming and causing a stroke.
Let's circle back to murmurs one last time, focusing on telling the difference between benign and serious, especially those diastolic ones. Can a murmur ever be okay?
Yes. The innocent murmur, sometimes called a physiologic or functional murmur,
These
are typically soft, grade 1 or 2, short, occur in mid-systole, don't radiate widely, and often have a vibratory or musical quality.
What causes them if not heart disease?
Usually just increased blood flow velocity across normal structures, common in children, adolescents, pregnancy, or states like fever or anemia. They aren't associated with any actual structural abnormality, and they often disappear when the underlying condition like fever resolves.
Okay, so innocent murmurs are systolic and situational. But you said diastolic murmurs are always bad news?
Generally, yes. Diastolic murmurs indicate a significant problem with either inflow restriction or outflow leakage during the heart's filling phase. Let's take two classic examples. First, mitral stenosis.
Narrowed mitral valve, often from rheumatic fever.
That's the classic cause, yes. The valve leaflets get thickened, stiff, maybe fused together, restricting blood flow from the left atrium down into the left ventricle during diastole.
What does that sound like?
It creates a very characteristic low-pitched, rumbling diastolic murmur. It's often described as sounding like distant thunder. You hear it best at the apex, using the bell, especially with the patient in the left lateral position. It might also be preceded by a high-pitched opening snap as the stiff valve is forced open.
Okay, rumbling diastolic at apex, mitral stenosis. What about the opposite problem, aortic regurgitation?
Aortic regurgitation, or aortic insufficiency. Here, the aortic valve doesn't close tightly during diastole, so after the left ventricle pumps blood out into the aorta.
Some of it leaks back down.
Exactly. Blood flows backward from the aorta into the relaxing left ventricle.
What kind of murmur does that create?
This causes a high-pitched, blowing decrescendo, fades away, diastolic murmur. It starts right after S2 and gets quieter through diastole.
Where do you listen?
It's usually best heard with the diaphragm along the left sternal border, maybe third or fourth ICS, Erb's point area, especially with the patient sitting up, leaning forward, and holding expiration.
And this leak has other consequences too, right? Like the pulse.
Yes. That backward leak causes volume overload in the left ventricle, making it dilate over time, leading to a displaced PMI. And the rapid runoff of blood from the aorta back into the ventricle during diastole is what causes those characteristic large, bounding, collapsing pulses, water hemorrhage pulse we talked about earlier. Everything connects. #tag7. Conclusion.
Wow. We have covered a huge amount of ground today. We've mapped out the whole system from the electrical signals starting the beat.
The SA node to the Purkinje fibers.
To the mechanical valve closures creating S1 and S2.
Lobe dub.
And then interpreting all those extra sounds, the splits, the murmurs, and linking it all back to what we see and feel in the neck vessels and the pulse. It really completes the full cardiovascular picture.
And the key takeaway always is clinical synthesis. Don't just collect isolated findings. Integrate them. For anyone studying this, remember the power of pattern recognition.
Like the example you gave.
Right. If you see elevated JVP, meaning high right atrial pressure, and you feel a displaced apical impulse, meaning enlarged left ventricle, and you hear an S3 gallop, meaning volume overload, that triad isn't just three separate things. It screams congestive heart failure. You move from just hearing sounds to understanding the hemodynamics behind them.
That's the goal. And maybe one last recap of those specific considerations for older adults from our sources. Safety pearls.
Good point. Remember, atherosclerosis is more common, so be extra gentle palpating carotids, and always listen for brutes first. Don't be surprised to hear a soft, mid-systolic murmur, often from mild aortic sclerosis, or even an X4 sound. These can sometimes occur with age without necessarily indicating severe active disease due to natural stiffening. And always watch out for orthostatic hypotension when changing their position.
Excellent reminders. Okay, to wrap things up, let's leave our listeners with a final thought to mull over, connecting sound back to structure.
Go for it.
We talked about the S2 sound, the dub, normally splitting into A2 and P2 only during inspiration. But what if, on careful listening, you hear that split, that doo-dub, and it's fixed? Meaning you hear it clearly and equally during both inspiration and expiration without any change. What specific structural heart defect involving abnormal flow between the heart's upper chambers should immediately jump to mind when you hear that fixed split S2?
A great question to ponder.
Think about it. Thank you for diving deep with us today.